If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'm joined by George Eaton and Raphael Baer to talk about reshuffle prospects, Philip Maughan talks to Kate Mossman about Iron Maiden, and Alex Hearn and I discuss the overhyped Hyperloop. I'm joined by George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, and Raphael Baer, our political editor. We're going to talk a little bit about Labour. So, George, you've just written something that says that Labour have got a kind of host of policy goodies, I think you call them, coming up, including repealing the bedroom tax.
Yes, that's right. So, over the summer, a lot of Labour activists, backbenchers, have been frustrated by what they see as a policy vacuum. And Chris Leslie, at one of the few big briefings they did on living standards, said we'll have some policy goodies for you. And I know that one of the policies that they are planning to announce before 2015 will be repealing the bedroom tax as a clear point of difference with the Tories, because it's become such a symbol of unfairness. Another is to build 1 million affordable homes, which sounds like a huge amount, but it's actually around the level required to meet needs. And they've already said that they'd build 400,000 were they in power now. And that will be, as a policy, it ticks all the boxes. I mean, it would create growth, it would create jobs, it's easy to explain, and it's a good dividing line with the Tories.
And Raph, why didn't they oppose the bedroom tax from the start? I mean, they sort of did a bit and then they didn't.
Well, yes, I mean, it's very interesting. My own view is that's a pretty sensible thing for them to be doing now, because, as I think we've discussed before, they were getting quite a bit of momentum at campaigning against the bedroom tax in theory, and it's very unpopular. The Tories seem to be on the back foot. They sort of trying to rebrand it as a sort of spare room surplus surfeit surcharge, whatever it was. It wasn't working. It all looked like their message was unravelling. And then when it came down to it, because Labour were in this business of wanting to sort of wait and see what the economy would do, not give away too much too early, couldn't predict exactly what the budget situation would look like. They didn't want to make any spending commitments, and obviously saying we'll reverse what is effectively a cut turns into a de facto commitment to spend more than the Tories. And so they couldn't say, and ended up in a position where they said, well, we don't like it, but we can't promise to get rid of it. And what a lot of Labour MPs said to me is that at that moment, all the wind went out of their sails, and they had this thing where they thought they had a bit of momentum, they were getting some traction, and then people just turned around and said, well, if you're not good for that, then what are you good for? So in terms of morale in the party and trying to get back some of that momentum, they clearly have made a judgment, well, it's not a lot of money. It probably doesn't actually even make that much money in terms of deficit reduction. It probably costs more. I haven't seen the numbers, but it's one of these sort of slightly useless gimmicky measures that probably does more harm than good, both fiscally and obviously socially. It's a good hit for Labour, and I'm not surprised they're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a story that we reported on of somebody who was disabled who had £20,000 worth of adaptations made to his home, and the idea that you then move him to another home that then requires all those adaptations paid for shows that, it, in fact, yes, it wouldn't have saved any money at all. Let's move on to talk a little bit about the upcoming Shadow Cabinet reshuffle. So, first of all, who's down and probably on their way out?
Well, this is a fantastic. Which particular hostages to fortune would
no,
you like
to
break?
Fun, you
although
know.
The one thing that it has been said very often now, and I've heard it from people who you would describe as sort of friends of Ed Miliband, more in sorrow than in anger, is that Stephen Twigg, the Shadow Education Secretary, just hasn't sort of troubled Michael Gove at all isn't made Michael Gove even break a sweat.
Mm.
And so close to an election, you need someone who could at least have get some purchase on the education debate. A lot of people would say actually the problem there is Ed Miliband. He doesn't know exactly how he feels about academies. He doesn't know what his own personal view on all sorts of public sector reforms are. But the bottom line is they need someone who's more effective at performance.
And very tough to shadow Michael Gove, who the media love and plays the media extremely
and has
well.
Friends in the media and is quite smooth. I mean, he's less popular, we're saying less popular with teachers. He's less popular on the ground. He's one of these people who he's this sort of he's a sort of a media taste, actually. But nonetheless, the bottom line is they need someone else in that job. A lot of people saying that Liam Byrne is a problem. The interesting thing there is that actually Liam Byrne's sort of policy framework in the sort of shadowing Department of Work and Pensions, talking about welfare reform, he's been instrumental in developing the scripts that Ed Miliband now more or less reads out himself, you know, recognising that a lot of Labour voters, other voters are very frustrated with the benefit system. They feel it makes a mug out of working people and that it's sort of got all sorts of anomalies, unfairness, waste built into it. You can argue the detail of that indefinitely, but there's no doubt that Labour politically needs to get into that space. Liam Byrne understood that. It was quite important at persuading Ed Miliband to accept that. But the problem is so many people on the Labour side see Liam Byrne as such a sort of outrider on that. And the sort of crypto-Tory ultra Blair polishing the jackboot that George Osborne uses to kick the poor kind of figure, that it's impossible to sort of get Liam to do the political front of house on that without getting cries of treason from the Labour side. So Ed needs someone who can actually sell.
So he's like one of those revolutionaries that has to do the kind of hard work, but then the first thing that happens is that after the revolution, their head has to be chopped off.
That's one way of putting it. It's also you need with Labour and welfare, you know, in party management, you need a kind of Nixon to China approach. You need someone who the Labour Party will see as sort of absolutely intrinsically, authentically heart beating on the left to say, "I'm sorry, guys, this is a lot of this stuff that Liam was saying is true, and we do have to do it." But I suspect that person can't be Liam.
And George, who do we? I think is on probably on their way up.
Rachel Reeves, who's returning from maternity leave shortly, I would say she's quite a good bet to replace Twigg at education, where she can also cover areas like childcare. And I think there's a sense that it might be good to have a woman go up against Michael Gove, to, you know, who's got this sort of slightly arrogant style, and someone like Reeves might, who's seen as quite sort of warm by the electorate, might be quite good at countering him. I think Owen Smith, the Welsh Secretary, who's been a sort of long-standing supporter of Ed Miliband, is in line for a promotion. And then you're going to have some who aren't in the shadow cabinet come in, like Stella Creasy, who's obviously had a high media profile over the summer, one of the few in Labour who has.
I wouldn't be surprised if Chris Leslie, who's covered Rachel Reeves's maternity leave as shadow chief secretary to the Treasury, gets to keep that job. Mm. He seems to have done it. Been competent.
And do you think that Chris Bryant's car crash on the Today programme will have now counted against him?
It was a pretty serious flip. Leaving of the road, turning the car upside down, left spinning in the central reservation moment. That said, it's not really Ed Miliband's style to make a judgment based on something like that, actually. I would say, I don't know what will happen to Chris Bryant, but I do know that, you know, Ed Miliband's, the way he does his politics, and the way what likes his politics to be seen is about taking this longer, more strategic view, not being short-term reactive, not responding to what, you know, he and the people around him call the froth of the daily sort of news stuff. So if Chris Bryant is now, I don't think it'll be because of that.
And what about the election campaign? Are there any signs?
They should definitely have one.
they need a campaign manager. And I think what they're going to do now is rather than appointing just one person to replace Tom Watson, they're going to have someone who will be the face of the campaign, who will be going up against Grant Shapps, effectively. And Owen Smith is one of those who's been spoken of for that job, along with Rachel Reeves. And then they'll be looking to hire a professional strategist from the US or Australia, basically their equivalent of Lyndon Crosby or Jim Messina.
Is that how you pronounce it? Have I been pronouncing it wrong all this time? Well, thank you, George. You've helped me there. I will promise faithfully to both of you that I will destroy all tapes of this if all your predictions are not true. But thank you, George and Ralph.
I'm joined by our arts editor, Kate Mossman, to talk about Iron Maiden, who played at the O2 Arena recently?
Yeah, on the 3rd and 4th of August.
Okay, so you went along. Have you got a long history with Iron Maiden? I know they're a band that a lot of people feel strongly about.
They are. I was curious about them. I'd never seen them before. And I got this email that said there's something called the Billboard Top 100, which is a weekly measure of gigs and the amount of revenue they create. Mm. And it said that for the first week of this Iron Maiden tour, which is called Maiden England, humorously, they grossed more than Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift.
Really?
And it's fascinating when you there are a few bands in the world who, just like them, and I think, you know, you could maybe say AC/DC are the same, possibly Aerosmith, although they're kind of in and out of rehab a bit. There are people who are just going around the world with these massive juggernaut tours. No one really talks about them. There's nothing new to say about them. Mm. And they're doing incredibly well, and their fan base isn't dropping off at all. And they're these kind of like these planets that they work to their own kind of rules. And I just thought, I've got to go and see them because I've got to see what all this is about.
Yeah, and they go to, you know, the Philippines, and they go to Japan and all these things, and it does kind of happen almost unannounced. You don't really ultimately notice it because nothing has changed. The status quo remains status quo.
Yes.
So you say that their audience isn't going down, but I kind of imagine now that there's a kind of, you know, quintessential Maiden kind of rocker guy with hair thinning, you know, maybe still done into a ponytail, but really shouldn't be, you know, leather jackets and so on. Is that not the case?
There is. I mean, we walked into the O2 and there was this surge of energy. It's like, I've only felt that at the O2. I mean, the O2 is a difficult venue to enjoy stuff in, as far as I'm concerned. I've only felt this with Bon Jovi and AC/DC and Iron Maiden. You walk in and suddenly you're in this kind of this warm rush of energy and this kind of feeling of rock building in the air, and just swarms of people walking around, and everyone at Iron Maiden gigs wears an Iron Maiden t-shirt. If you go into a Topshop today, you can buy a Rolling Stones one or a Ramones or an Aerosmith one or something, and they've kind of been, you know, those logos have been sent out and sold off in the past, and you just put them on, you don't have any interest in the band, and it's a fashion statement. But Iron Maiden, I think, are one of the few bands that you wouldn't wear the t-shirt unless you were really part of this clan, and you'd feel like somehow you were insulting them if you did. You wouldn't go and just buy one as a kind of, you know, a cool rock thing to wear. And I think they are. The audience was made up of the rockers that you're talking about and their children. And there were so many children under the age of 12 there who've been born into this this passion and were wearing these kind of mini Maiden outfits. Their icon is called Eddie the Head. And there was a little boy who was wearing a huge Eddie flag as a cape, and he was about, you know, 4'2" or something like that, and he was completely swamped in this regalia. And it was really sweet. And you think, like, the thing about the generation gap crunching, as it's always doing in rock and roll more and more, you know, you always listen to what your parents were into now. And with these guys, it was the sweetest thing. You just think that they're going home in the car just singing along to Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, you know?
Yeah. I thought, reading your review, it seemed like there's maybe a politics that comes with this as well. I don't know how much, you know, the politics of the band. There's quite a lot of talk about Bruce Dickinson and what his interests are, you know, how that kind of corresponds, and whether there's a certain sectorism of society that's particularly adept to them. I don't know.
I think he had it forced out of him on that Hard Talk programme that he was a conservative and a Eurosceptic. But, you know, I think, to be fair, lots of...
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
People of his generation who have made that kind of money would naturally be quite conservative, because, and he sort of makes a point of saying, I'm not a tax exile. I live in this country. I mean, I'm sure he's got lots of offshore kind of companies and things. But he's not living in Ireland in order to pay no tax, or the Cayman Islands. And these people have just amassed huge fortunes, and they did move into, this generation of rock stars did move into castles and buy suits of armour and live the life of a gentry, in a way, in a lovely kind of modern version of the upper classes. Now they now all are Mick Jagger's age and sort of old rockers and stuff. And I think he is the thing that I found funny, I never really thought about their Britishness, that they are so cartoonishly British. There's constant Churchill voiceovers and Second World War backdrops, old war films of, you know, cavalry being shot and things like that. And then you've got him in his waving a Union Jack, kind of jumping around stage. And it's not, I don't think it's as thought through as it may look. It's just what they do. It's just their shtick. And it's obviously, it's unifying in a kind of quite an innocent, rather sweet way, that you do get a feeling of kind of that they are a bit of a British institution and we are all there kind of waving our flags and, you know, being sort of bonded together by this experience, but in a way that's kind of harmless, really. It's not yeah. jackbooted or anything.
It's not, yeah, it's not quite a rally.
No, no. It's the most sort of meaningless rally you could possibly get.
Yeah, okay. And are they still making music?
Yeah, they had the album in 2010, I think, got to number one in 28 different countries or something. It was called The Final Frontier. I'm sure it wasn't their Final Frontier. But they, his voice is, he's one of those weird, it's very bizarre high wail to his voice, which is utterly at odds with his speaking voice, which is obviously the sign of all kind of great singers, that you can't believe it's the same person. And he is this quite straight character who famously runs a... sort of, I think, a semi-commercial airline. He's certainly got a company called Cardiff Aviation that deals with hangar space and pilot training and all these very sort of sensible signs of aviation. And then he'll go on every night and do this, and he's extremely fit still. And he's kind of young for a rock star. He's about 54 or something like that. He's not the Stones' age. And there is a kind of, you know, there's a revival of hair metal and these kind of big mainstream rock acts at the moment. But I went to see Whitesnake a few months ago, and you really felt there that it's only barely being held together because the voice was kind of shot, and David Coverdale was really camping it up, and it was a bit like a Carry On film. It was kind of, you know, and then you get something like that that's just this perfect little machine just doing its thing.
Yeah, and it seems to work so well with sort of the O2 stadium machine as well. Yeah. Not only is the music conducive to being in a stadium, but the whole kind of like machinery, you know.
Yes, yeah, because you have to be big to fill that slot. I mean, you've got to have... I mean, Bon Jovi didn't have the backdrops and stuff as far as I recall, but I know that AC/DC have their big blow-up woman called Rosie. So as long as you get some kind of, you know, proper 80s spectacle on stage, it's okay. But there's a kind of suggestion that there's a new Queen project that's going on in the autumn called the Queen Extravaganza, which is the first time someone's actually done a really kind of conscious franchising of a band. They've taught a load of young musicians how to play their songs, and they're sending them off on tour. And this was suggested back by, I think, Yes, or maybe Journey, in the 70s, as a model of what may happen to the legacy once the band's too old to do it. And it's really interesting that there is a movement towards basically like very, very polished tribute acts that are going to kind of keep the songs out there while the band gets old and retired. And in a way, Maiden are one of the last few bands that have still got the kind of the physical fitness to be doing it just as well as they were 20 or 30 years ago. Maybe one day they'll have a franchise as well. Yeah. But at the moment, they own it.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. I've got to get my CV off to a few ageing rockers right
yes.
now. Thanks very much, Kate.
Cheers. Thank you.
I'm joined by our junior monorail correspondent, Alex Hearn, to talk about Elon Musk's plan to essentially run a giant tube under California and fire people through it. It's this project called the... I mean, that sounds mad, doesn't it, Alex? But that is what he wants to do.
It's not under California, it's over California. This is part
of
the problem.
I'm so sorry, that's not mad at all.
So what Musk has announced, and it's a preliminary proposal, is the Hyperloop, which is, like you say, a big old tube running between LA and San Francisco, which he will fire capsules through at up to 700 miles an hour.
What I like about this is, you know, there was a thing when the early trains came that people went, if the human body goes beyond 30 miles an hour, mm-hmm. you know, people's eyes will fall out. Is there any problem with people going at 700 miles an hour?
At 700 miles an hour? No. But one of the things that has come up out of this is that it's a rough sketch of an idea. And one of the things this rough sketch of the idea includes is the hope that there'll be no regulatory oversight, because actually accelerating and going around corners at that speed is the body is subjected to twice what you're allowed to subject people to under current American transportation rules. It'll be a vomit comet, basically. You'll be shaking up and down and left and right at quite high G-forces. Like, still half gravity, but not what you want from a nice, comfortable transport system. Also, if the emergency brakes come on, you'll really want to have your seatbelt on.
So you're really selling it. You should probably go and work as a PR guy for this thing. So, I mean, this is what essentially a kind of napkin sketch by Elon Musk, who's the guy behind Tesla Motors, where they're doing the electric cars, yeah. And he's the man who made millions and millions from PayPal, the online payment system.
And, I mean, to give him fair credit, he's also the man behind SpaceX, which is... sounds exactly like Hyperloop, a mad pie-in-the-sky idea. It is a private spaceflight company. But it's now been around for 11 years and actually is contracted by NASA to deliver things to the International Space Station. So this is a man who is very good at taking ideas that people laugh at because they are quite obviously science fiction and making money from them. At the same time, it's a napkin sketch, the Hyperloop, but it's a 67-page napkin sketch. It's relatively well detailed. And there are some things that seem fundamental to the very concept, which just don't really work that well.
So it runs on a kind of air cushion, is this right?
So
it's essentially a big tube.
It's a big tube.
It's
a big tube, and then the tube is low pressure. So all the way, space throughout the tube are pumping air out of it. That's because if you go too fast in a tube, it's like trying to shove a plunger down a toilet. Everything builds up in front of it, and you can't go any faster than a set maximum amount without essentially superheating it and dying. Dying! So they take all the air out of the tube and then they use what is basically a rail gun to accelerate capsules up to 700 miles an hour. The capsules take air in from the front and push it out at the bottom, thus floating along on a cushion of air. This is all fine. This is actually vaguely workable. We know we can do this. The question is whether we can do it for $6 billion, which is the amount Musk has put on it. That's a tenth of what the California high-speed rail plan is actually offering a fully costed proposal to do.
See, I want to talk about the California high-speed rail plan, but first of all, I want to say, do you know there's a ride at Alton Towers called Rita that is essentially a rail gun, but that fires you very fast, and it feels awesome. And therefore, I would like this project to be like that, but it won't be. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It's supposed to be a commuter system.
Yeah.
It's supposed to, but the volumes that it carries are really small, right?
Well, this is so. There's two sets of problems with the Hyperloop. There's the ones that are just slightly glossed over in the proposal, and then the ones where the proposal seems to be not true. The ones that are glossed over are the fact that even at the absolute maximum capacity that Musk says it could theoretically run at, which is one capsule every 30 seconds, it can only carry about 4,000 people an hour. That, for a commuter system, is minuscule. Mm-hmm. That's four tube trains. It would not be usable.
There are 1,000 people on a tube train.
You can fit 1,500 people on one of the new Metropolitan Line trains.
Feels like it too. Sorry.
But yeah, you couldn't carry that many people on it. So even if...
And presumably if it breaks down, the fact that... I mean... Like, the tube has serious problems when the trains are running 1 minute apart.
Yeah.
The fact that you then get stuff stuck. You don't want to ever stick anything in a tunnel. You want to keep it at a station.
If you have to fire something off every 30 seconds and you're using 40 capsules with only six slots in each station, and you know, there are problems that are going to come here. The other big thing that's slightly glossed over in the proposal is that it's LA to San Francisco in the biggest air quotes imaginable. It's more like if you were doing a London to Edinburgh thing, stopping at the Scottish borders at one end and Oxford at the other. They're really not that useful for people who have no private transport in one of the cities and need to get to an office, especially if they want to commute from San Francisco to LA, which has no known public transport system discovered by man.
It's funny because your blog about this talks about the idea about it's a shame if this detracted from Californian high-speed mm-hmm. rail. And having been around the east coast of America by rail, that's kind of all right and pretty
it's
good
doable.
Because there's a good corridor between Washington, Philadelphia, and New York, caused by a lot mm-hmm. of, I presume, senators and congressmen and their staff who want to get between the two of them. But apart from that, America has got a very sketchy rail infrastructure, hasn't it?
Yeah, broadly it's because the only thing that uses rail in any large numbers is freight, and freight trains are long, sparse, and they wreck timetables. So even passenger transport sort of has to chug along behind freight trains, which is why it takes an age to do anything. The California High-Speed Rail Plan is a plan to build a European-style high-speed rail network. It's still massively pulled over by American regulatory problems. So, for instance, they have to build much heavier trains that can't go as fast. But most of the cost difference between the Hyperloop and the high-speed rail plan is just because the Californian high-speed rail plan actually goes through LA and San Francisco. And if you're trying to buy land in LA or San Francisco to run tracks on it, you are going to spend billions and billions of dollars. Musk avoids this by just not going there. And that is a way of saving money, but not really a way of building a transportation system that people actually want to use.
But it's a bit like Ryanair when they claim to fly you to Sweden and they actually fly you to Norway or Denmark, and then you sort of have a short hop across the border and 5 miles.
Yeah, and it's fine for holidays, it's fine for vacations, but you're not going to commute on it. And that's what Musk is pitching the Hyperloop at. For a 35-minute round trip, it would be possible, but currently only if you're commuting from one specific part of the LA suburbs to one specific part of the East Bay, which is an odd commute.
And on a final question about rail, why can't we have a rail system like you have in Japan?
The really boring, nerdy answer is that the Japanese rail system is mostly built on twin tracks. So the high-speed rail are entirely dedicated tracks just for the Shinkansen. We're trying to build an entirely dedicated track just for high-speed trains. It's not going too well politically.
Mm. Thank you very much, Alex Hearn.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you for listening to the New Statesman podcast. I was joined by George Eaton, Raphael Baer, Philip Maughan, Kate Mossman and Alex Hearn. Our theme music is taken from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, used by Creative Commons. Join us next week and find us always online at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.